Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to another edition of ID the Future. I'm your host, Todd Butterfield. Last time we began a discussion with Nancy Piercy about her book, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality. It's very profound, as are the implications. I'm going to jump right back to more questions for Nancy, who has a lot of real wisdom and stories about this topic. Nancy, you've alluded to how the Darwinian view and what comes from it affects life and death situations in our country and around the world. We have people who speak out as society's ethicists. And in a sense, strangely, even though morals are the second floor, they tend to want to define morals. So how have Darwinian ethicists developed a standard for when we become a person, or have they? Or does it depend on the person you talk to?
Well, that's a good question, because it does depend a lot on the person you talk to. A lot of people can compartmentalize their thinking so that there are people who can, in their professional lives, say that we are essentially biochemical machines who function by purely material forces. And let me give you an example. Steven Pinker, who's now at Harvard, in his book, How the Mind Works, literally says, when I'm in the lab, I treat people as complex biochemical machines. Data processing machines is his favorite term. I treat people as complex data processing machines. But when I go home for the day, when I take off my white lab coat and go home for the day, he says, and this is a direct quote, he says, we go back to treating one another as free and dignified human beings. In other words, what he's saying is, when I go home to my family, my wife and my kids, I can't treat them like complex data processing machines. I have to leave my professional worldview behind and accept a worldview that really doesn't even fit what I hold is true on a professional level. So that's what we're seeing with an awful lot of examples. I give examples on this actually in my book, Finding Truth. I have a whole chapter on this, on how very many secular people, especially in academia, will claim to be materialists in their work lives, but who will admit they can't live that way in their personal lives. One of the examples that my students tend to remember best is Rodney Brooks at MIT. He's emeritus now, but he used to head up the artificial intelligence lab there. And he has a book called Flesh and Machines. And in that book, he says the human being is nothing but a big bag of skin full of biomolecules interacting by the laws of physics and chemistry. And he says, I know it's hard to see people this way, but when I try, I can see that my children are machines.
Wow.
And in the next sentence, he says, is that how I treat them? Of course not. I give them my unconditional love. And then he says, I realize that is very far from any rational analysis. Well, yeah, if you define rationality by a materialist worldview, then loving your own kids is irrational. And then he ends the paragraph this way. If you ask him, well, how do you put these two together then? You know, that we're biochemical machines versus, you know, loving unconditionally. He ends the paragraph saying, I maintain two sets of inconsistent beliefs. And so this is an example of how secular people will sometimes adopt, you know, intentionally adopt. And let's use our upper lower story metaphor. In the lower story, they will adopt a Darwinian materialist evolutionary worldview that says we're essentially complex biochemical machines. And then when they can't live that way, because I would say because it doesn't fit the real world, when they can't live that way, they kind of develop an upper story where they say, well, I can't really deny free will. I can't really deny love. I can't, you know, I can't really treat my wife like a complex data processing machine, or at least I'd better not. They develop a kind of upper story, which they don't treat as really true, and yet which they treat as something you cannot live without. So this is a fascinating kind of dualism that is held by a large number of secular thinkers today, where they're essentially holding views that are inconsistent with their stated views.
It's so subjective and certainly isn't scientific. It almost seems unhinged. How do scientists and this may not be in your area of expertise, but you seem to know a lot about a lot of things, such as biologists. Explain away what to us is obvious design, and why do you suppose they deny that there's a design?
Yeah, you would think that when observation clearly shows design, like I was on a radio program recently, and the host was trying to make it a God versus science kind of theme. And I said, design is not necessarily a Christian view. And Plato and Aristotle recognized design. Cicero recognized design. It's been recognized since ancient times by people who had no concept of God, of the Christian God at least. It's evident to observation that living things, living structures, all serve a purpose. And so it is pretty clear from Darwin's own thinking that the main reason for denying design is to get rid of any sort of mind behind it. As soon as you have purpose, you need to have a personal agent. As soon as you have direction, a directing intelligence, you have a personal agent. You know, as soon as you acknowledge that things are not just random, then you are forced to acknowledge the possibility of a mind. And so I think that there is perhaps greater, not so much of a scientific motivation, but maybe a personal motivation for many people in terms of not wanting to recognize a designer. Because you see, to go back to the examples that we gave a moment ago, if you want to test a worldview, you take it into the world, right? That's kind of like the test for an overall philosophy of life.
Sure.
Just like a scientific theory, you test by taking it into the lab and you see whether the chemicals react the way the theory says they should. In the same way, you go into the real world and you test your ideas. And when you find so many people like Rodney Brooks and Steven Pinker who say, I have a worldview, but I take it into the real world and it doesn't work. Another one is Marvin Minsky, who has written a book in which he too argues that we are essentially machines. He says the mind is a complex computer, and computers work very well without free will, and therefore humans have no free will because our minds are complex computers. And then he says, however, we cannot live this way. We cannot treat people as though they were complex computers. We cannot live as though we were machines. After all, we make decisions from the moment we wake up in the morning. And as he puts it, he says, we are forced to believe in free will, even though we know it's false. And that's a direct quote. He says, we're forced to maintain this belief in free will, even though we know it's false.
Unbelievable.
We know it in the sense of, you know, it's contrary to our philosophy. So again and again, at least on the professional academic level, we're seeing materialist Darwinist thinkers who say, I cannot live by my worldview. Now, to me, I would think that's a pretty good sign that maybe there's something wrong with your worldview. That falsifies it, that you should go back to the drawing board and reconsider your starting premises. But see, when I was young, and I became a Christian when I was in college, and at that time, people made arguments, and Christians would make arguments like, if you accept a materialist worldview, you must give up the notion of free will because it reduces human beings to machines operating by material forces. And if we are completely explicable by material forces, then obviously there's no such thing as free will. It becomes impossible. And at that time, that was primarily a logical argument. Today, it's no longer just logical. In Finding Truth, I gave example after example after example of thinkers who admit that they can't live by their worldview and who admit that they have to create a sort of upper story where they acknowledge the reality of free will, love, creativity, and so on, even though their worldview tells them it's false. By the way, do you know why they concentrate so much on free will? I used to think that was just one issue, and I thought, well, why, you know, one issue is not that powerful. It turns out that they argue the issue of free will because it's a stand-in for all the other distinctively human features. Because everything that's distinctively human, pretty much all the features that are distinctive to human beings depend on free will. Mm. I mean, think of it, we wouldn't have moral choice. You don't have moral responsibility if you were coerced to do something, if you had no choice. Creativity, so there's all of art and literature. What else? Even rationality. You can't say you have a rational thought if you were pre-programmed to believe it. It wasn't a rational choice. So the free will is kind of a stand-in for all of these distinctively human traits. And so when people like Marvin Minsky say, we cannot give up the notion of free will, even though we know it's false, he's talking about the whole range of distinctively human traits, which a reductive materialist worldview cannot explain, and which, on the other hand, we, in practice, we cannot deny.
We're speaking today with Nancy Piercy, author of Love Thy Body, and it's really getting good, isn't it? And my thought about what you just said is most of this seems to be fueled by rebellion. People don't want to acknowledge the logic because they want to do what they want to do. I want to turn to another story that I either heard you say on C-SPAN or read. I thought it was very interesting. And just one more aha moment. Judith Butler, founder of Queer Theory, said she recognizes that her body naturally wants to be in unity with her gender and sexuality, yet calling it unnatural is oppressive. See, there's the rebellion. So she explains it away as just a body of accidental patchwork with no connection between those things. What would you tell her if you could talk to her and those who read her works and agree with her?
Yeah, it was very surprising to me when I first started researching in these areas that there were a lot of people who agreed that if you accept homosexuality or transgenderism, you accept essentially a fragmented, fractured, dualistic view of the human person, which is very self-alienating and self-estranging. Because I would argue that this is one of the reasons we should accept a design view of nature, because then a design view of nature says we should live in accord with our design, and you will end up, therefore, with a harmony between the different parts of your being, between your sexual identity, your gender identity, your biological identity, that we are all happier and healthier when they are in harmony. And Judith Butler, right, I think you mentioned she's the founder of Queer Theory and tremendously influential among radical college students. And it was fascinating to me to read her book. Her best-known book is Gender Trouble, and to hear her say, in a sense, on the one hand, we all do want to be in harmony. We want that coherence, that consistency among all the different parts. But because she herself is a lesbian, she does not fit that. She is out of harmony. So she simply declares, well, harmony is not real. You know, coherence is not real. Sexual unity, internal unity, is a myth. And so the way she puts it is the idea that there's a natural connection between biological identity and sexual identity is a myth, is a fallacy, is a fabrication. Those are some of her terms. To which I would say, well, how do you know that? Just because you don't fit that, why do you think you should propound a theory that tells everyone else they should not experience harmony? And the same thing with transgenderism. I was reading a philosophy book defending transgenderism. And I repeat, it was a defense of transgenderism. And yet, this was by a Princeton University professor. And yet she said transgenderism involves disconnect, disjunction, self-alienation, self-estrangement. These were all her words. And I thought, how are you promoting a theory that would cause people to experience disjunction, disconnect, and self-alienation, self-estrangement? I mean, this is an open door for people who promote the notion that our bodies are designed. It's just an open door for us to be able to make a positive argument.
I'm going to ask you, how could someone use your book as a starting place for reestablishing the science and the beauty and the morality of our intelligently designed bodies in our local communities, or even our universities? I live in a college town, so it occurs to me to be a proponent and use your book. How would you suggest that could be started?
Well, for many people, I think it helps if you start with, the personal stories in Love Thy Body. Another one that really struck me was, again, a story of a woman who was homosexual. And her name is Jean Lloyd. And as a teenager, she wore a tuxedo to her high school Christmas dance. as a defiant symbol of her gender bending, and lived openly as a lesbian for several years. And then she said, I began to trust that when God created me, that he created me and my body as a good thing. He designed my sexuality. He designed me as female. And this was, he did this for my good. See, again, it's a high view of the body. It's saying that the body is good. The created order is a good thing. And she said, I love this phrase. She said, to my own great surprise, a flicker of heterosexual desire emerged. And today she is married with two children. And so what is the difference? You know, in none of these stories did someone say the difference was made when somebody came and shook their finger in my face and said, this is wrong. You shouldn't do it. The difference came when she accepted her body as a good gift from God and acknowledged that if God has made me female, then ultimately, no matter how I feel right now, ultimately I will be more fulfilled by being with a male. And of course, vice versa. If a man is born male, he will ultimately be more fulfilled living as a male and interacting sexually with a woman. And the thing is, our feelings can change, and they often do. The most reliable marker of who we are is our embodied identity as male and female. And so the Christian morality is in tune with our body, and it leads to a sense of identity that's in harmony. And of course, once in a while, someone will read Love Thy Body and say, well, wait a minute, because we're not used to that. Some people think it's overemphasizing our biology because, of course, I acknowledge in Love Thy Body, in the book, I say, of course, humans are much more than biological beings. But the key question on all these moral issues turns out to be, do you accept the created order as a good thing? For example, in this case, is the differentiation of male and female a good thing? Do you accept it as a created structure or do you reject it? Do you affirm the goodness of creation, or do you deny it? I have found that one of the most persuasive arguments, by the way, with my secular friends, is to go back to what Camille Paglia said. Remember, Camille Paglia said, she calls herself a pagan lesbian, and she says, we have absolute claim to our body and may do with it as we see fit. And I give them a kind of an environmentalist argument. I say, we can't do as we see fit with nature. If we do that, that is exactly what has given us destruction of our environment and pollution and so on. When we see that tree out there, we can't just do with it as we see fit. We have to honor what it is as a tree. One of my favorite quotes from history, the history of science, is Francis Bacon. Bacon said, in order to control nature, we must first obey her. And his point was, if you're going to be able to interact with the environment without being destructive, you must first know the rules of nature, the laws of nature, and live in accord with them. You cannot contradict the laws of nature or you'll be destructive. You must first obey her. And I say, it's the same with your body. If you're not going to be destructive, you have to know the order, the structure, the laws that govern your body and live in accord with that. And what's fascinating is many of my secular friends find that to be the most persuasive argument. They say, oh, yeah, okay, I get that. I get that. We should honor our bodies. And all of these, from abortion, euthanasia, homosexuality, transgenderism, all of these issues end up, when it comes right down to it, all have a low view of the body that does not honor the body. And it is actually the Christian ethic that gives greater value to the body. And that's an argument that my secular friends have actually picked up and said, okay, that one makes sense.
Well, that's very, very powerful. And it sounds like in some, your solution would be personal contact. And ultimately, I would like to add to that, read your book, give out multiple copies, because it addresses something that I just personally don't think is talked about much amongst many. It's a point of view that is so powerful that needs to get out there. So I'm just going to say you'll need to get your hands on this book. Nancy Piercy, thank you for writing it. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you, Todd. I really appreciate it.
For ID the Future, I'm Todd Butterfield.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.